Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Ryan Silvey, State Senator from Clay County on the Missouri side.
We're glad you're here. Let's get started.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. And welcome to the production studio here at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. It is good to have Senator Ryan Silvey with us from the Northland. Also joining us in the studio today to talk about politics and about the State House and about the life of a senator are Matt Staub. He is runs a digital marketing agency and has a robust social media presence as well. Matt, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And also from KCUR, my colleague Ellie Moxley. Welcome, Ellie.
Good to be here, Brian.
Before we get into all that, I know you've been on KCUR's radio programs before, but you've never joined us on State House Blend.
Right. This is a first.
We would like to begin the way we always do, which is having you tell us about your family and your pets.
Oh, okay. So I'm married and we have two daughters. One is a senior in high school this year, soon to graduate, and the other's in fourth grade. Their names are Taylor and Callie.
All right. Senior in high school, that big plans or lots of uncertainty about big plans?
You know, I think she's reached that stage where she's just ready to be out of school.
Okay.
Definitely.
That's a plan.
Second semester senioritis kicking in. She's looking at going into nursing.
Okay.
So I expect her to go to Metropolitan Community Colleges for her registered nursing degree.
Very good. Seems appropriate that Dad's been working on the on the education of the state of Missouri, and then she gets to take advantage of it.
Yep. She's just excited to be that close to being done. I can remember that. We also have a dog, since you asked about pets. Chloe is our Bichon.
Ah, okay. How long has Chloe been with you?
4 or 5 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, excellent. The other question I always like to ask is, how did you get involved in politics? And you, in spite of being maybe one of the younger folks in the legislature, are also one of the longest serving members of the legislature.
Yeah, it's a weird quirk of term limits on that one. But
yeah.
I am the youngest in the Senate right now. So I think after the next election, you'll probably see someone younger. I really got interested in high school, to be honest, through high school debate. I was in the academic debate competitively. Through college, I also debated all 4 years in college, and was just really drawn to the idea of being presented with a problem, trying to develop a solution to the problem, and then trying to convince people that your solution is the right one, or conversely, trying to convince somebody that someone else's solution is not the right one.
All right.
Which really is just what we do in the legislature.
Yeah, so it's high school debate was the perfect preparation.
It's where it began.
I remember those days well. Ryan, tell us about your district. What is this little square of Clay County like that you serve?
Yeah, so geographically, it's very small compared to most of the other Senate districts because they're done by population, and we have a very dense population north of the river. So it starts at the river. The river is the southern boundary. So think Broadway Bridge into the downtown airport is right into the southwest corner of the district. The western border is the Platte County line,
okay.
So it's just in Clay County, none of Platte. And the northern border is the northern boundary of the city limits of Kansas City. So think just south of Smithville, actually outside the 435 loop, but just south of Smithville. Then it goes east and picks up the city of Liberty. So it's really only 138 square miles, and it has about 180,000 people in it.
But in that 138 square miles, you've got some urban, you've got some rural, you've got suburban.
It's a pretty fascinating district, demographically speaking, because when you look at political affiliation, for instance, it's one of the few districts in the state that's a true swing district. It actually leans Democratic. It's about 54% Democratic. You've got in the southern part of the county, demographically more closer to urban, and then as you get north, it's more suburban. I mean, we've got everything from multi-million-dollar homes in Briarcliff and Staley Farms to trailer parks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very diverse set of interests that you have to constantly be in check with when you're dealing with constituents.
That is fascinating. I want to hear more about that. But first, I want to go around the table and see what's on the mind of the rest of the folks here. Matt Staub, what are you thinking about for Ryan Silvey today?
Well, my big angle is I live downtown. I can see your district out my window. I live in the River Market right on the river. And it seems so often when we're working on city issues, I'm pretty active with the city, that the only time we mention Jeff City in the state legislature is because of its impediment to our progress as a city. And we so often become the people that have to deal with the consequences of certain budgetary decisions that are made by largely rural interests. And so I'm wondering, how can we make, like other states have, the state legislature more of a partner in building cities, which are obviously the vast majority of the economic production of our state?
From a political standpoint, the cities, both Kansas City and St. Louis, have traditionally, in the last decade or so, lost quite a bit of influence simply by the members that are being elected from there. There aren't a lot of Republicans elected in Kansas City or St. Louis. There's only a handful of us. But Republicans have dominated the rest of the state, and we have two-thirds of the legislature. So when the people that are most inclined to speak up for your interests are in the minority, they don't get as much attention. I think that's the short answer. Now, how do you fix that, aside from electing members of the majority?
Right. I was just going to say, so you're advocating for more Democrats to be elected?
No, I'm advocating for more suburban Republicans, because there's only a couple of us down there. But aside from that, I think, continuing to try to build that dialogue, even though the members who may represent your physical district are in the minority, but trying to broaden the dialogue to talk to those that are in the majority that happen to be from your region, I think would be helpful.
Is there ever a challenge, you know, as a suburban Republican who maybe has more insight on city and urban issues than, say, a, you know, rural kind of mid-Missouri Republican, southern Missouri Ozark Republican? Is there ever a challenge when you're trying to talk to your same party colleagues about maybe issues that you don't feel they understand about what it's like to live in one of the urban areas in the state?
Yeah, I mean, that's a constant challenge. You know, there are a lot of things at the state legislature that don't necessarily break on party lines, but some of them end up taking on that tone, and they don't necessarily work with the interests of suburban communities. And so you'll find some of us end up voting back and forth. There are very few suburban representatives that are party line people when you consider how the rest of the legislature votes. Not necessarily like partisan, what's in the platform partisan, but how the rest of the legislature votes. And so we do end up kind of trying to straddle those interests of voting back home without alienating leadership.
Right. I'm struck by the fact that you probably find yourself having more in common in terms of the interests that are important to your constituents with more Democrats, at least within the Kansas City metro area. I know there is a Kansas City caucus of legislators. I don't know how active that has been in this session so far. Is that something that you think can be effective, is important?
Yeah, I think it is helpful to have those types of regional relationships across party lines because, again, since a lot of things in the legislature don't break on party platform partisanship, having a region stand together is very helpful. Most of the issues that we deal with do end up breaking urban versus rural or east versus west or suburban versus everybody,
right?
You know, so it really helps when you can have a regional coalition across party lines.
Ellie Moxley of KCUR, what's on your mind today?
I think the issue I'm hearing about the most here, you know, the governor was in town about a week or two ago talking about education, but also about, you know, things like the earnings tax and as well as campaign finance reform and ethics reform. What are you kind of seeing on the ground in Jeff City at this point? And, you know, as you said before, as someone who kind of occupies this unique position between urban and Republican and suburban, what are you seeing? What's your kind of take on what's going on?
You know, there is a big conversation going on about ethics reform, but frankly, that's a conversation that we have almost every year on some level. It's a little more intensified this year.
Because some bills moved very quickly through the process. The bills, for example, requiring a one-year waiting period before a legislator could become a lobbyist. The bill limiting, to some extent, the gifts that lobbyists can make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those came over from the House very quickly. Actually, both chambers have been moving quicker than any of my previous sessions that I remember. They both have new leaders, new Speaker of the House, a new President Pro Tem in the Senate for the first time ever in mid-session, really, mm-hmm. between the 2 years. You know, I think that we're going to probably see the House put out a bunch of bills separately, and they've sent us multiple bills dealing with, as you said, one with the waiting period, one with the gift ban, one with I don't think they've done one on campaign finance specifically yet. But they've got several different ideas of what ethics reform should look like, and they've sent them separately. I think what you'll see is once we kind of get a feel for all of those in the Senate being sent to us, they will probably all likely get referred to one committee, and we'll probably try to flesh them out as to which ones are going to move forward and which ones are not. But it is an interesting conversation that we need to have. I mean, you frequently hear that we're the only state without any ban on what lobbyists can give legislators as far as gifts. And also, there's no limit on what you can donate as far as contributions. I think you'll see something happen on one or both of those areas.
Well, you said on KCUR is up to date with Steve Kraske about a month ago today. You said, obviously, when someone receives $1 million or $500,000 from one person, that creates a perception in the electorate and doesn't help with the trust level in government.
True.
You're a month in. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that legislation is going to emerge?
I think that leadership in the Senate has said that they're open to that conversation, which is movement from where we've been in the last several years. But again, what I also said on that show was, and I want to be very clear about this, I will support limits when they come through, reasonable limits. But I also firmly believe in my heart that it will do nothing to change the system. Right. Because I think those limits will always be circumvented, and they'll just be less transparent. And actually, I've run under both systems. I ran under limits when I first got elected 12 years ago, and I've run under the non-limit. In fact, I voted to get rid of the limits because it wasn't at all transparent.
Back in 2008 or
yes.
Something. Yeah. Ellie, you shook your head
a little
bit. Well,
I guess my thing is I'd like to think that in 2016, you know, we can come up with some kind of system that has limits and transparency and can kind of balance some of these issues. I mean, are you guys at all worried? I feel like people on the street are saying this ethics thing, like after all the scandals and shakeups last session, you know, we really need to get something done. Or is there any sense in Jeff City that there could be a backlash with the electorate if, you know, something doesn't get done on campaign finance?
I don't know if there's really discussion of there being a backlash. I mean, because I'll be honest, when I go to coffee shops in the district, which I do a lot when I'm here on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's not what people want to come up and talk about first and foremost. It is what the media likes to talk about. But when people come up to me at Starbucks, it's not usually to talk about that. You know, we have tackled this before. We passed a very comprehensive bill, and I don't remember what year it was, probably 8 or 7, somewhere in there, that included a total ban on gifts, among other things. And the Supreme Court ended up throwing that out. So now we're back in the situation again because they've thrown out our previous attempts at reining this in. And the reason they did that was a campaign finance provision, which basically said one political action committee could not contribute to another political action committee.
They weren't specifically ruling on the question of a contribution limit from an individual.
Correct, on that aspect. But it gets to the heart of the problem with transparency. If you cannot prohibit one committee from giving to another committee, which the state Supreme Court has said you can't, and this was prior to Citizens United, by the way, which now has complicated the issue even more. If you can't keep one group from giving to another group, no matter what the limits are, you'll just have unlimited groups moving money around and then funneling it back in one direction, which is what we had before. You know, we had the situation. I think if you really believe that a limit, even if it's transparent, even with transparency, a limit will rein in the money coming into the system, I think you greatly underestimate the resolve of those getting the money into the system.
So I'm curious, almost every state has limits of some sort. So are we basically saying it's a wholesale national failure of state governments to limit that? That if ours can't work, then what's happening in other states?
I think what's happening in other states is it's probably not transparent. I mean, what really drove this whole conversation, and I talked about this on Up to Date too, but when you have one billionaire, and we have more than that now that are in this system that are actively contributing to campaigns. But when you have one billionaire who wants to give money, if there's a limit, as there was in 2006, you know, prior to that bill, in this instance, one of them started 100 different political action committees on his own, funded the attorneys and the accountants to make it all legal, funded all of those political action committees by himself, then all of those political action committees could legally write the maximum check to a candidate. So it was after the 2006 election cycle, I believe, when that became the norm, that everybody said, well, this is stupid. We should just get rid of the limit. If somebody's going to give 80 grand or 100 grand, let the people see that. And then the voters can determine if their representative taking those types of checks, if they should vote them out or not.
So when we had your colleague or your, on the House side, Kevin Corlew, here a couple weeks ago, he proposed some specific numbers that he thought should be the limits. Another Republican willing to make those suggestions. Do you have specific numbers in mind? Would you introduce legislation on this subject?
I probably won't introduce legislation simply because my plate's pretty full and it's not an issue that I'm super engaged in. If the numbers were to be discussed, just off the top of my head, I would think. And I don't know what Kevin told. I don't know what Kevin's numbers are, so I'm a little bit of a disadvantage here. But, you know, I would think that it, in a House race, it should probably be no less than 1,000. Probably double that for a Senate race or 2,500 and then a little bit higher for a statewide.
Yeah. Yours are lower than his. I believe he said 5,000, 10,000, and 20,000.
Yeah, I would vote for that, too.
All right. Well, let me ask you about some other legislation that you actually have introduced in this session about Real ID. Mm-hmm. So, again, this is the need or the desire on the part of many for Missouri to come into compliance with federal legislation about what's required for IDs to be accepted at airports, among other places. Missouri is one of just a handful of states that voted some time ago not to comply with that legislation. You're trying to fix that.
Well, I actually engaged in this going back to 2009 when we passed the bill prohibiting Real ID in the first place. I served on the committee where the bill came through, drafted a committee substitute and got it voted out of committee that would have done what essentially I'm trying to do now, which says we should let individual citizens decide whether they want to participate in the Real ID program or not. And then essentially have a two-tiered system of what driver's licenses we offer. Because I think there are real concerns by voters about privacy and the size of government and that sort of thing. And I don't want to downplay that at all. I think that they shouldn't be forced to participate if they don't want to. But at the same time, I don't think that we should be prohibiting citizens who don't want the inconveniences that will come with not having it to have to deal with that. The federal government knows far more about me personally based on my past work history than they would ever learn through the Real ID program. So for me, it's nothing more than an inconvenience because they already know all of that information. So
does that satisfy you, Matt Staub? Do you feel like two driver's license options is does that satisfy your concern? It lets you get on an airplane.
It at least gives us an option. I do feel like we're shooting ourselves in the foot on an ideological sort of standpoint that we so resent any mandate that we're willing to really inconvenience our citizens over it. And that doesn't seem very representative. I know this is at least a patch for that, but it seems kind of foolhardy in the first place, I guess. There was a lot of uproar, obviously, on social media about, like, nice one, Missouri, you know.
I guess I'm more interested from a practical standpoint. So I moved back to Missouri from Indiana a couple years ago, and I go to the DMV and I go to the one in Sugar Creek because it's usually not very crowded, and I still end up, you know, waiting and an hour for, you know, to get a driver's license and to do that. And I guess my concern is if we have to move to a different system, am I going to have to, even though my license is good for, you know, several more years, am I going to have to go back and do all that again?
Well, if we don't do anything, you're going to have to get a passport or some other form of federally accepted identification. So from my perspective, at least if we had a dual system, it wouldn't be a huge inconvenience or cost to the citizens who want to fly on a federally regulated aircraft after 2018 and that sort of thing. To get a passport, it's, what, $80, $100? I mean,
Which
I also have a passport, too.
Yeah.
I mean, so
right.
For me personally, if this doesn't get fixed, I just carry my passport whenever I need to have what would have been a Real ID. But I don't think that everybody is in that situation. I mean, clearly there's a lot of people that can't afford a passport, don't need a passport. Maybe they don't travel internationally. It just seems silly to me that we don't have an option for those people that's normal.
And like you're submitting to a much more invasive set of security inquiries when you get a passport.
Well, and you know, one of the things back when this debate started during the early promulgation of the Real ID rules, there was, you know, there was supposed to be a microchip in it and some other stuff, and people freaked out. And when I had that debate on the House floor, I pointed out if you're going to drive people to a passport, it does have a mic. Mm-hmm. You know, it has those things that you're saying you don't want people to have to deal with. and you're basically forcing them to pay for it on top of it. So it's pretty silly.
What do you think are the prospects for this legislation? You're not the only one talking about it. Everyone seems to agree something needs to be done, but is it going to happen?
You know, some of the members, particularly around the military bases, are motivated to find an answer for this.
Because they need it for that, too, getting on the base.
Correct. And while the military personnel themselves obviously have ID that matches federal regulations, the civilian contractors don't. And so now you've got this whole added layer of hurdles, and you know, the base commander has a lot of say on what that process looks like if your ID is not compliant. So I'm hopeful that we can at least provide the citizens a choice. You know, the people that push back against Real ID the most like to talk about liberty and, you know, and the government is infringing on the liberty. Well, I think the purest form of liberty is letting the individual decide for themselves whether they participate or don't participate, not me as a state government saying you don't have the option.
Would it be fair to say, I mean, I kind of look at the Real ID issue and I don't see it as a party line issue, because I think that there are both Republicans that are very concerned about liberty and privacy and government intrusion. And I also would say the same for liberals, that they're also, many of them worry about, you know, is someone keeping tabs on me? Is the government compiling, you know, all of these records that they could eventually use against me? I mean, is that the kind of sense you get, or is it in Jeff City, is this more of a Democrat-Republican issue?
I don't see it as a Democrat-Republican issue. I do see it as more of an ideological issue and where you fall on the spectrum. It typically tends to be it's kind of funny because a lot of people think of the political spectrum as a line, like far left to far right, but I truly believe it as a circle. And the farther left you get, the farther right you get, the closer you actually are in a lot of issues. So it really seems to be the far left and the far right that are the most concerned about blocking the implementation of Real ID. But again, I just don't know how you get any more pure form of liberty than letting the person decide for themselves how they want to proceed and to interact with their government.
So one more sort of legislation-specific question I have. You're the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. You chaired the House Budget Committee before you came over to the Senate. A lot of the headlines that we cover here at KCUR, and especially on State House Blend on the Kansas weeks, has to do with their budget, which mm-hmm. Has had a series of problems, it's fair to say. Missouri doesn't get those kind of headlines around the budget, but even in committee hearings this week, you've raised that there are some real tight spots in the Missouri budget, including your concern that the governor is not provided for a supplemental appropriations bill that's probably going to be necessary. Where do you see the Missouri budget coming out? Are we going to see a budget that ends up with a deficit that needs to be resolved?
I don't know where we will end up on the issue of the supplemental, to be honest.
And maybe explain that a little bit. What is the issue there?
Our budget, our fiscal year runs July 1 to July 1, right? So we come in, we pass a budget that takes effect on July 1. We leave in May, the budget takes effect on July 1. When we come back in January, you're halfway through that fiscal year. And so we have what's called a supplemental appropriations process where we look at, okay, what has been the actual spending trend on all of these departments, and is there some place that's spending faster or looks like it's going to need more money than we gave them for this fiscal year, and we pass what's called a supplemental appropriation to finish them out for the year. For 8 consecutive budgets now, we've had a budget presented by the governor that goes all the way up to the bottom line of what consensus revenue says is in the bank. It doesn't set any money aside. And then they come back in January and want another $100 million, $200 million, this year $300 million. So that means that he has to make ongoing cuts in the current fiscal year to set the money aside to spend on the supplemental to finish out the fiscal year. So it's been a mess, and there's very little forward-looking planning. And there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, if you're the governor and you're going to give your State of the State speech, you want to be able to spend as much money in your speech and make as many people and programs happy as possible. So you don't want to leave money in the bank. If you're the legislature and you're looking forward to, okay, we're going to have to deal with a supplemental, there's some thought that we should be the ones to set that aside. But then what does that mean? Well, that means we go into the governor's budget and we cut $200 or $300 million out of what he's requested and to set it aside for the supplemental. And then we look like the bad guys because we made $200 or $300 million worth of cuts. So there's give and take in that process and that thought. But as far as the overall health of the budget, Missouri's revenue is growing. It's not necessarily growing fast enough to outpace cost to continue, particularly in Medicaid. So that means that our current programs are growing faster than our revenue is growing, which puts us in a tight spot as well.
Right. I mean, it's the possibility of Medicaid expansion that really throws the socket wrench, right?
Well, I don't think that there's going to be any Medicaid expansion this year. And it's a topic that I've been involved in the past, but I just don't see this legislature moving forward to add more people to Medicaid on the horizon of a new gubernatorial and a new presidential election.
And is that ideological as you see it, or is that financial?
You know, I think it's primarily ideological at this point, to be honest. I mean, for when I was chairman of the House Budget Committee, I was very opposed to the concept from a fiscal standpoint. When I looked at the issue and felt that it was something that needed to be solved, I came up with a fiscal solution for that. And I naively thought that once I had a balance sheet that balanced, that I could show it to everybody and they would go, oh, okay, well, now that it's not going to cost as much money, let's do it. And I found that that wasn't the case. So I have to say it's ideological.
And the federal government pays for, and just I'm making sure I know what I'm talking about here, but the federal government pays for that with the Medicaid mandate, 90% upfront, right? So that's effectively, ideology aside, like a huge windfall of income into the Missouri economy. Well, of course, it does obligate us to the 10% and then a growing obligation over time. But is that part of the conversation, that we should be bringing as much as, you know, wealth into the economy as we can?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two parts to that. You know, one, as you mentioned, the 10% match that we have to come up with is a concern moving forward. And, you know, it's like I was telling, you know, people before, the coolest house in my district is probably about $4.5 million. I mean, probably the most expensive house. I would love to have that house. But if somebody came to me today and said I could have it for 10%, I don't have $450,000. Yep. I don't make that much money. So I, even though it'd be a great deal on that house, I still couldn't take the deal. So that's part of the concern. The proposals that I had addressed that part of the concern. But then you get to the larger philosophical concern. That 90% match is not free money. It's federal tax money. So people are paying taxes to pay for that 90% match. So then the question becomes, you know, are we just putting a bigger burden on people through the federal government as opposed to the state government?
Or are we just giving it to another state when it could be rightfully ours?
Except the way that the Affordable Care Act is structured, that money doesn't get diverted to another state. It just doesn't come to us.
I want to ask another question about sort of the mood in Jefferson City. We were talking earlier about ethics reform. You mentioned that there's a new House Speaker, there's a new Senate President pro tem. The stage seems to be set for a new day, a morning in Jefferson City. Does it feel that way? You're a month into the session. It's also a presidential election year, kind of the silly season a lot of years. What's happening there? How does it feel?
I can tell you it does feel very different. You know, the circumstances surrounding the speaker's turnover and the Senate the previous pro tem leaving to become a lobbyist. I think both of those things have driven, again, the ethics conversation a little bit more than usual. But they both have very different leadership styles, too, than their predecessors. And seeing that occur all at one time in the middle of a sitting legislature has been really fascinating, actually. The president pro tem of the Senate, for one, has empowered the chairman more than any president pro tem I've ever seen. Because when a bill gets filed, it then has to be referred to a committee by the president pro tem. And in the Senate, it has to go in order. So if there's 300 bills filed, he can't pick and choose and cherry pick where they go. So typically what pro tems in the past have done is used that as a way to slow everything down, because if I only refer 10 bills, they're going to be the first 10 bills and everything else just has to wait until the next time I refer bills. This president pro tem has cleared everything out. I mean, I filed a bill on Wednesday and it was referred Thursday, which, I mean, several hundred bills in the Senate have already been sent to committee. And we're only a month into it, and that's unprecedented. So every chairman now is sitting on a stack of bills to decide which ones rise to the level of even getting a hearing this year.
Yeah, you have to say, though, like, that sounds like the way it should be, right? I mean, that when a bill is submitted, it should be referred to a committee. It doesn't seem like that should be the exception.
You know, usually they get there at some point, but you know, so I'm chairing a committee this year in commerce, and I already have, I think, 25 plus bills sitting on my desk. And now basically what that's done is it has empowered me to look at those 25 bills, look at the hearing schedules and decide, okay, well, I physically don't have time to hear all 25 bills. So now I'm going to be making that decision, as opposed to the past where the pro tem would say, well, I'm going to kind of control the flow of the calendar by sending those out. So it's been really empowering for the chairman.
Well, I was going to say, it sounded to me when you were explaining it the first time, it kind of sounded like delegating, like, you know, you're the committee chair, you're the one that probably knows the most about, say, commerce or the budget or whatever, and, you know, you're the one that's making the decision as to which of the bills that have been filed are the most important for your committee to hear.
Personally, I think it's great. It's not normal. I mean, I knew anyone who's been chairman for a while is not used to just having everything dumped on their plate and then you making all of the decisions. So the decisions have a lot of times been top-down driven. So I think it's great. But it does add new challenges because in the past, you look at the calendar, you may only have five bills in your committee. So if you only have five bills and you've got a calendar to look out and say, okay, well, we're going to hear them on this date. But with 25 bills, like I physically know I don't have enough time to hear all of them. So I'm making decisions now that previous chairmen haven't had to make. So it's an adjustment.
One more time around the table with questions, Matt Staub.
So I guess transportation is another big one. And obviously that's something as an urbanite that's sensitive to me at an urban scale. But I feel like Missouri was famous for having the cheapest gas and cigarettes. And that was our claim to fame. And as long as you were smoking them, if you had them, you ignored the bridges that were falling over. So you know, will there be the courage for us to address the revenue side of things? I was reading a Marshall Griffin article yesterday about a proposal to raise the gas tax to potentially address our transportation shortfalls, which are significant. What are we going to do about that?
First of all, we've put two tax increases on the ballot in the last 4 or 5 years, and both of them have been rejected by the voters. So I don't know that there's the sense in the legislature that we should just keep throwing up tax increases when the voters don't seem to show any
One was a sales tax, right?
One was a sales tax. I think they were one was a sales tax. I don't remember what the other one was, but we've done two transportation ones recently, and then there's been some cigarette tax increases and things.
Right.
So what I've started thinking about is, you know, we always say, okay, well, here's all the money that we spend, and here's the revenue that we have. What nobody ever really seems to do is go back in and say, well, what are we spending it on? You know, I mean, and not just from a programmatic standpoint, what are we spending it on? But it really crystallized for me this summer. I went with MoDOT on a tour of the Broadway Bridge, you know, the structural integrity tour. So I'm hanging in a bucket up under the bridge looking at this thing.
That sounds like the worst part of being a state senator to me, but go on.
Sounds awesome.
I thought it was cool.
Okay, well, yeah, all right.
I thought it was cool. But what struck me the most was, okay, so everybody knows that the Broadway Bridge is going to need some sort of repair and because these things have life cycles. So I'm talking to them about... We keep falling back to when we don't have enough revenue, the Highway Commission falls back to what's called the primary road system. There's the primary road system and the supplementary road system. The Broadway Bridge is not a primary bridge in the state of Missouri. And that blew my mind.
Nope, that's true. I did a big story on bridges. They didn't let me up into the bucket, though. I'm a little disappointed. They told me they didn't let, you know, the rest of us do that. But apparently, if I, you know, run for office, maybe one day I can get in the bucket truck.
And there you go.
Is that because it's not an interstate or because it's not enough traffic? It's only two lanes?
It's because there's basically other routes.
Each way.
Well, it's because of the way our system has been built. And so it prompted me to go dig into it and find out what the primary system is, what the supplementary system is. The primary system is actually laid out in statute. That statute was written in 1936, I believe, so pre-World War II, and I don't think it's been amended since then. And it laid out that every county should have a north-south route, and every county should have an east-west route. And then the two cities that were the biggest at the time, Kansas City and St. Louis, had more routes than that. In Clay County, the east-west route that has the most traffic is 152 Highway. The east-west route that's on the primary system is 92 Highway between Kearney and Smithville, which is ridiculous. Again, nobody's ever gone back and looked at what the system is. So then I asked for a map of, oh, I want to see every road that's under state maintenance. And it blew my mind. It was like a spiderweb mess. I actually posted it on my Facebook page, I think. I've probably tweeted it out as well. But if you gave somebody a blank sheet of the state of Missouri and said, draw me a state-level road system, nobody would come up with what we have as our state road system. So then I started looking at, okay, well, what if we pared that back? What if we had a more arterial system? Because we have 33,000 miles under state maintenance.
Wow.
Comparable states in population and size have between 12 and 16,000 miles. So we're taking care of way more than we ever should have been taken care of. And so I started looking at the history of how did we get here. And in the 50s and 60s, we took on more roads from the counties. And so all these roads are state roads. It should not be state roads, in my opinion, which harms the cities and the areas of growth, because we're spending money putting oil rock on roads that have less than 400 cars a day instead of amassing money to build projects for bridges like the Broadway Bridge. So we're working on a plan to kind of pare that down, and figure out a way. Obviously, there's been a lot, because I was in the Star about this, and then people freaked out because they're like, oh, you're just going to give all the roads back to the counties and they don't have the money to pay for it. Not at all what we're talking about. We would have to come up with a way to help the counties shoulder the burden of those roads. But the concept of what we're paying for is ridiculous. And we never look at that side of the balance sheet. We always look at the revenue side and say we need more revenue. We never look at the maintenance side. I mean, if you had an arterial system, and we had several different, we had MoDOT give us several different ideas for what that would look like. The most arterial system, so the least little spiderwebby roads, would save us like $380 million a year in maintenance, you know? And we were talking about, you know, how are we going to come up with $40 million? Well, here's a plan that would save $380 million, you know, and make it, you know, arterial roads. So I that's not an easy conversation to have. Of course, it goes back
especially
to our very first conversation.
Especially from a suburban legislator.
Exactly. It goes back to our very first conversation of urban versus rural and all of this. And I'm getting a tremendous amount of pushback from my rural colleagues because it means that their roads will no longer be taken care of by the state. But at some point, we have to have a conversation, and it's hopefully going to be a multi-year conversation on what is the appropriate role of the state in roads.
One last question from Ellie Moxley.
Well, you know, you said your daughter's a senior, and so you guys are obviously playing the college cost game at your house, I'm sure. I know that yesterday we had a guest on Up to Date talking about possible, you know, access to college and access to scholarship money for college, and whether or not maybe the Bright Flight program that, you know, is supposed to combat brain drain and keep our bright students in the state, if there's a more equitable way to distribute that. Do you think we're going to get much movement this session talking about maybe access to college and how to get maybe more rural students and more students of color into our state's higher education institutes?
Yeah, I think you will. I mean, the governor's proposal for higher education funding included more money for Access Missouri scholarships in particular, which Access Missouri is not merit-based. And then you have, of course, the Bright Flight program, which is merit-based. Both of those had recommended increases in funding, if I'm remembering off the top of my head. So I think we will have that conversation, and I think it is important because, you know, a lot of times we pigeonhole these programs or these line items and, you know, it's just higher ed or it's just whatever. But when I talk to, you know, economic developers or businesses that want to locate here or those sorts of things, higher education is important to them. It is an economic development issue as much as it is an education or higher education issue. So I think that, you know, continuing those conversations and driving colleagues to look at it in a bigger picture idea of what it means for our state's economy as a whole, not just what it means for a specific institution or their constituents going to college, I think will get us there.
So one last question from me, Ryan. You mentioned earlier that you're the youngest member of the Senate. Is that right?
By about 2.5 weeks.
By about 2.5 weeks, which means that I could ask the same question of your almost the same age colleague. Our crack research team has unveiled that this year you will be celebrating your 40th birthday. Is cake allowed on the floor of the Senate?
No, no. Not on the floor. Okay. No. It would have to be in the office to have the cake. Okay.
Is that written into law somewhere?
It is. It's in our rules.
So. The rules of the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that would be my first priority, is to get rid of that no cake rule.
Right. I'm glad Matt Staub's platform is now out there for America to judge. That was Matt Staub. He is in digital marketing and is a social media presence as well. Matt, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
And also my good friend and colleague, Ellie Moxley, a general assignment reporter here at KCUR 89.3. Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you.
And finally, Ryan, nothing helps us get to know our guests better than getting inside their head and hearing the music that plays there. You get to choose the closing song of this podcast.
Ooh.
By sharing. It can be one of your favorites. It can be something you've been thinking about. Maybe it can even be a statement on the state of Missouri right now. Whatever it is for you.
You know what? Although this is going to be prior to 1968,
right.
Let's do Rain or Me by Who from Quadrophenia.
Rain or Me by
The Who.
The Who.
Off the Quadrophenia album.
Wow, that is very precise. an excellent choice, according to my producer, Matthew Hodapp. So thank you so much for being here, Ryan.
All right, thank you.
That's Senator Ryan Silvey, who's a Republican from Kansas City's Northland. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, that's a great way to keep up on the show and also on the news from Jeff City. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff. He's at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag StateHouseBlend. Sam did something last week where he invited other people to say their Twitter hashtags if they want to. What's yours, Ryan?
It's pretty simple. It's at Ryan Silvey, RyanSilvey.
I'm a follower, and he's prolific. Matt, what's yours?
I'm at Staubio, Staubio.
Very good. And Ellie?
I'm at Ellie Moxley.
You lucky people who actually got your name as your Twitter handle. You can find a shorter version of us on the air every Tuesday morning. Up to Date makes a little space for us there. That's at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. If you have any other thoughts or to be on the show as one of our citizen guests, send me an email. I'm at brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.